Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Logging In Using Technology in Practice to Improve Young People's Mental Health. My name is Ellie Robinson, and I'm the Executive Manager of Practice, Evidence and Engagement here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. In today's webinar, we will hear about the role of technologies in young people's lives and how they might be used to support young people's mental health. Before I introduce our speaker today, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we're meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. Before we begin, I need to alert you to some brief housekeeping details. One of the core functions of the CFCA Information Exchange is to share knowledge. So I'd like to remind everyone that you can submit questions via the chat box at any time during the webinar. There will be a limited amount of time for questions at the end of today's presentation, and we will try to respond to as many as possible. We'd also like you to continue the conversation we begin here today. To facilitate this, we have set up a forum on the CFCA website where you can discuss the ideas and issues raised and submit additional questions. We will send you a link to the forum at the conclusion of today's presentation. Please remember that this webinar is being recorded and the audio, transcript and presentation slides will be made available on our website and YouTube channel in due course. Accessible versions will also be available. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's presenter. Dr. Michael Cargreg is one of Australia's most prominent child and adolescent psychologists. He is the author of 9 books, and has worked as an academic, researcher and political lobbyist. As Managing Director at the Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre, Michael plays a key role in leading and implementing the digital education program both in Australia and internationally, and works to extend the reach and impact of the Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre's initiatives. Michael's extensive use of technology in his clinical practice gives him particular insight into the valuable role that technology can play in the diagnosis, treatment and prevention of mental health problems. Michael has also recently been appointed to the board of the Australian Psychological Society. So without further ado, please join me in giving our presenter a very warm virtual welcome.
Thank you very much, Ellie. Over the past century, we have split the atom, we've spliced genes, we've sequenced the human genome, and even roamed Tranquility Base. And in July this year, a piano-sized probe called New Horizons showed us with unprecedented clarity a range of majestic mountains under endless plains on the planet Pluto, 6 billion kilometres from our sun. My love of technology began as an 11-year-old, and I remember watching in awe as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. I remember being mesmerized by the launch of Voyager 1, a little space probe launched on September the 5th, 1977, and its mission was to study the outer solar system. I especially loved the fact that Voyager, in case it ever encounters aliens, is carrying photos of life on Earth, greetings in 55 languages, and a collection of music from Gregorian chants to Chuck Berry, including a song by 20 bluesman Blind Willie Johnson, whose stepmother blinded him at the age of 7 by throwing caustic soda in his eyes, and he died alone and penniless of pneumonia after sleeping in the ruins of his house that burnt down. But thanks to this amazing technology, on August the 25th, 2012, his music left the solar system. Fortunately for me, my love of technology is now combined with my love of essentially adolescent mental health. I work for the Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre. We're based in Victoria, and essentially work in very close partnership with young people. Participatory design is very important in the work that we do. We have 75 plus partner organisations, including governments and a plethora of universities. And we look at the exploration of new and emerging technologies to promote mental health and wellbeing, but also to diagnose and treat it in young people. We work with researchers, practitioners, policymakers, and innovators across the academic, not-for-profit, government and corporate sectors. And we have just developed the world's first online certificate in young people's mental health and technology. This goes live in November, and we have very fortunately partnered with Origin, the National Centre for Excellence in Youth Mental Health. If you are at all interested in doing this online course, and if by the end of this webinar you are really interested, just log on to the Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre and register an expression of interest, and we'll be in touch with you. So the current situation when it comes to young people's mental health is that there would appear to be several really quite significant risk factors that are impacting adversely on young people. They might be family breakdown, sleep deprivation, obesity, early sexualization. But what we do know is that mental health problems are really quite common in young people. 1 in 4 young people have a DSM-5 criteria mental illness, and 1 in 7 children. In fact, it would seem that being a young person in 2015 is more complex than it has been previously. 28% report moderate psychological distress, and suicide, sadly, is still the leading cause of death for young people aged 15 to 24. And later on in this broadcast, we'll talk about how technology might be used in the prevention of youth suicide. The latest research, completed by the Telethon Kids Institute in collaboration with the University of Western Australia, released just in August, really did reveal the nature and extent of the problems young people face. In what is now the largest ever survey of youth mental health, this 2-year study looked at 6,300 families and found not just that 1 in 7 children experienced a mental disorder, but 1 in 10 were self-harming. 15% of the 16 to 17-year-old girls had suicidal ideation, and 1 in 40 had actually attempted suicide. What we do know is that a relatively small number of people actively manage their well-being. They seem to know relatively little about a healthy diet, exercise, mindfulness, or the all-important sleep hygiene. To provide evidence for this assumption that young people aren't doing very well, we need only look at the Mission Australia Annual Youth Survey, the nation's largest survey online, which takes, if you like, the temperature of young people's mental health between 15 and 19, and it's been run every year since 2002. If you just look at the results for 2 years ago, you can see that over 50% are either extremely concerned, very concerned, or somewhat concerned about coping with stress, school and study problems, body image, and depression. And in 2014, the same issues, same order, but greater percentage. So whatever we're doing doesn't seem to be working. We need to get better. We need to get more efficient. What we do know is that if we look at the healthcare system, it is struggling. We know that it costs over $140 billion a year, or 9.5% of GDP, and with the aging population, the increased prevalence of chronic disease, and the increased numbers of risk factors, it's quite clear that the current system will be unable to meet the demand. On the other hand, the really good news is that Australia leads the world in evidence-based mental health services, many of which are targeting young people. And these services have been shown to encourage well-being and increase help seeking. So what are e-mental health programs? Well, it's long been recognised that the internet has been used by young people, and it's long been recognised that we as mental health professionals can put programs on that make a difference. The first e-mental health program was put online 25 years ago. The first study was done in 1990, a trial of cognitive behavioural therapy delivered by a computer and tested against a therapist. And even back in 1990, both were found to be equally effective, particularly for mild to moderate depression and anxiety. There's now been over 40 different studies that show that e-mental health is better than placebo. And in fact, a number of studies have shown they are as good as therapist intervention, which has enormous implications for our rural and remote people. But clearly one size doesn't fit all, and not all consumers necessarily like e-mental health interventions. But if they do suit a particular person's way of getting information, they can be highly effective. E-interventions have been applied to a vast selection of mental health conditions, and effective interventions now exist for depression, anxiety, alcohol, eating disorders, as well, of course, as the enhancement of well-being. We know that young people are, in fact, almost always online. 90% of them have internet access at home, almost 70% use a smartphone, and almost 60% use their mobile phone to go online every day. There are now more mobile phones in the world than people. Smartphone use accounts for the majority of the recent growth in global mobile devices, and they are clearly advantageous when it comes to young people because they're anonymous, confidential, cheap, and of course, very appealing. Associate Professor Leanne Hides highlighted this when she talked about the fact that we now have, as psychologists, an unprecedented opportunity to provide real-time standardized health information and treatment direct to young people in their natural environment. It's estimated that there are now more than 100,000 health-related apps. Most of these target exercise, diet, and weight loss. And these are the most popular. Interestingly, there are about 700 mental health apps, but at the moment they're not used extensively by young people. This is a shame because it's quite clear that technology has afforded mental health professionals the potential to rapidly increase access to treatment, and this could potentially result in population-level improvements in mental health and well-being. I use apps, web-based programs in my clinical practice and have done so for 5 years, particularly around psychoeducation. I use apps on my iPad for screening and getting feedback from my clients. I have web-based programs that can teach young people social and emotional competencies like anger management, problem solving, and decision making. Apps enable my clients to self-monitor and track, allow me to track their treatment progress. I even have apps that I can give my clients for on medication to make sure that they're compliant. I use apps to give my clients homework, to train them up in particular skills, to manage their own anxiety and depression. And of course, there are now a plethora of web-based programs that encourage help-seeking behavior. The bottom line is that we can now help the 70% of girls and the 80% of boys with mental health problems who just don't seek help. We have got the potential to develop accessible, empowering, and sustainable models of mental health care through technology. And this, of course, will result in lower overall delivery costs, less demand on the clinical workforce, and of course, overcomes a lot of the problems with stigma And of course, with young people, their desire to be anonymous and to have confidentiality can be assured. Not only that, but in my psychoeducation efforts, they can learn at their own pace. Programs such as LiveWire, programs such as What Now for Canteen, allow young people with chronic illness, for example, to collaborate with peers. It's a particularly fantastic eating disorders app called Recovery Record, and many of my clients with eating disorders love the opportunity to collaborate with similarly affected peers on a mediated website. And of course, it is cheap for consumers who are traditionally very price sensitive. Many of these programs are simple, easy to use, and require no particular skill. They're easy to access, anonymous and free. And for clinical professionals such as myself, we can get reports which can guide us in the treatment of our clients and with the overall treatment plan. There is no doubt in my mind that technology can and is improving and augmenting existing assessment, diagnosis, and treatment for young people. There is a fear by some in the sector that this will in some way take over from them or make them obsolete. These are all used in conjunction with face-to-face treatment. A really good example of this is the Headspace Psychosocial Assessment Interview. Now, this was developed many, many years ago in 1988. Goldenring and Cohen came up with a way of interviewing young people. It was called the HEADS analysis. H stood for home, E for education and activities, D, depression, drug use, suicidality, and sexuality. Interestingly, this particular format of interviewing young people has taken on great currency and is used, for example, at all Headspace centres across Australia. One of the great things about this is that the Centre of Excellence adapted the original HEADS assessment interview and changed it to the Australian context. And it extended the domains covered to allow the detection of more serious mental health problems. The Headspace Psychosocial Assessment Interview consists of screening and probing questions. It's particularly good for younger practitioners who perhaps don't feel confident to conduct the full interview. They can just basically complete the screening questions they feel competent to address, and if those questions suggest the need, they can refer on to another more experienced practitioner. What's particularly interesting is that Sally Bradford, a provisional psychologist and PhD candidate at the University of Canberra, decided to take the HEADS screen and to put it on an iPad. And what she wanted to do was see whether or not, in fact, if you create this in a digital format, whether or not it made any difference. So her PhD looked at giving a number of young people the HEADS assessment through the iPad compared to a similar HEADS assessment delivered face-to-face with a clinician. What she discovered was quite extraordinary. She actually was awarded a prize from the former Prime Minister as a result of this amazing research. What she discovered was that young people were much happier to disclose information to the iPad than to a clinician. And this particular slide shows the really quite staggering increase in disclosure, particularly over traditionally, shall we say, sensitive areas like substance abuse, sexual orientation, self-harm, and unsafe sex. Her research showed at least 10 times, up to 10 times, the rates of disclosure over and above face-to-face interviews. So the idea behind this is that it will be developed by the CRC into an app sometime next year. And workers with young people in health, education and welfare will be able to use this particular app to gain valuable information from their clients, which hopefully will result in the greater potential for prevention and early intervention, improved help seeking and self-disclosure, reduced costs, and a reduction, hopefully, in suicide, self-harm, and accidental death. This is one really concrete example of how brilliant the technology is and the sort of advantages that can accrue with its judicious use. Of course, it's not just about apps. Australia has an enviable number of e-mental health portals, and these are really wonderful for clients to get more in-depth information about mental health issues. They can learn about specific information on signs, symptoms, and diagnosis. They can learn about the various various services and programs that are available to them, what the problems might be, the advantages and disadvantages with various medications that they get. Of course, the other thing is it allows them access to other people's experiences of mental health issues or services on moderated websites, a validation of their experience and concerns, and provides them with a range of strategies to guide their own recovery and to learn from other people's journeys. And of course, it also encourages help seeking and increases mental health literacy. And of course, there's no stigma with this whatsoever. The major Australian mental health portals, which I encourage all of you to visit, are listed here. One of the great things about these is that they're constantly being updated. Mind Health Connect is a website which aggregates mental health resources and content from the leading health-focused organisations in Australia. It includes fact sheets, audio and video content. It was launched in July 2012 and focuses primarily on the high prevalence disorders of depression, anxiety, stress, eating disorders. The other website that I strongly recommend to all workers with young people in health, education and welfare is the Beacon website. This is your portal to online apps and web-based programs for mental and physical disease. It's part of a suite of self-help programs developed and delivered by the National Institute of Mental Health Research Centre at the Australian National University. One of the things I love about this as a practitioner is that I can go to this website and I can click on a particular button which relates to which particular condition a young person might have. And one of the amazing things, as you can see, is the vast array of conditions that I can check. Alcohol, depression, phobias, sleep problems, smoking, and substance abuse are just a few. The idea being that as you click on these, you get a range of different apps and web-based programs, but more importantly, they are rated in terms of the evidence base. So if you were to go to the depression one, the first web-based program you see is in fact Mood Gym, developed by Professor Helen Christensen at the ANU. And what that will tell you straight off is that there have been no less than 7 randomized controlled trials showing the efficacy of this particular program for mild to moderate depression and anxiety. So it is with a great sense of confidence that I can use Mood Gym with my clients, particularly as homework or even in session for explaining the fundamentals of cognitive behavioral therapy. This is going to ruin your weekend if you go through every single one of these and go through. But really, if you're going to be as interested in e-mental health as I am, you'll happily give up your weekend. Mood Gym in particular is a cognitive behavioral therapy-based intervention designed to prevent and treat depression. It helps my clients identify and overcome problem emotions and develop really good coping skills. It consists of five different modules, and they take about 20 to 40 minutes to complete. You'll also see a range of other programs there, all of which have similar evidence bases, and really it's a matter of you exploring them before you suggest them to a client. There are also some fantastic resources now to help young people with anxiety. One of my favourite is Reach Out, Breathe. This actually helps my clients reduce the physical symptoms of stress and anxiety simply by slowing down their heart rate using a mobile phone or, believe it or not, your Apple Watch. It measures their heart rate using the camera in their phone. This is really wonderful technology, and once you've demonstrated this in session, my experience is that young people will basically use this. There is a really fundamental principle here, and that is that I cannot be with my clients when they're having an anxiety attack. But in 2015, you can bet your bottom dollar that they'll have a mobile phone with them, and therefore they can be trained to use these particular apps when they need it. Another really interesting set of apps and web-based programs are designed to assist with well-being. I'd encourage you to go through these slides once the webinar is over and actually have a look at some of these. They are brilliant. Balanced, for example, is an interactive goal-setting app which I use to help my clients develop healthy habits, and it seems to motivate and support them to achieve positive and healthy goals in their life. So you can also have a look at some of the other ones as well. Some of them are based on positive psychology, such as Happify, but they really are, I think, excellent. And if you go to the Beacon website, you'll see that they're all listed there as well. And of course, generally speaking, they're apps designed to assist with well-being. And I have to disclose my conflict of interest here. I am on the board of Smiling Mind, but this is an app which has now had over 800,000 downloads across Australia. It is modern meditation for young people, a very simple tool that gives a sense of calm and clarity and contentment. One of the really special things about Smiling Mind is that it's one of the only apps which is divided up by age. So there's a particular section in the apps for 7 to 11-year-olds, another one for 12 to 15-year-olds, another one for 16 to 22-year-olds, and of course there is one for adults as well. Now, when we talk about high prevalence disorders, of course, we can't move away from the issue of substance abuse. So I thought I'd give a little example of how I might use some of the programs that are available with a client. And I'd like to introduce you to Toby. He's 19. He's been smoking cannabis and drinking alcohol since he was in year 9. He lives at home with mum, dad, and a sister. He dropped out of school after year 10. Now, periodically attends TAFE because he has this goal of completing year 12. Both of his parents are unemployed. His new friends at TAFE are, I'm afraid, not necessarily what we would call pro-social peers. They're heavy drinkers. They use quite a bit of cannabis and ecstasy. And his use of alcohol and cannabis seems to be on the up just lately. His parents suspect episodes of injecting other drugs, but he doesn't want to talk about that to them. He's been missing classes. His motivation to study is approaching zero. And there is a lot of conflict at home. He's been interviewed by the police. He's now on a caution. Things are not looking good for him. What sort of options are there for me? Well, apart from seeing him and talking to him and trying to get his point of view, one of the things that I can do with Toby is I can sit in my office with two iPads and I can download a free web-based program called Clear Your Vision. Clear Your Vision involves essentially 19 specific steps. starting with him choosing which of the four characters you can see on the screen that he most closely identify with, and moving through to the changes he wants to make and how. In between that, he actually gets to sit the SDS, which is the substance abuse scale, substance dependence scale, and he actually can see objectively whether or not, in fact, he does have a dependence problem. It's quite amazing the number of times I've used this. Parents might have told the kids they're dependent on cannabis, but they only really truly believe it when an iPad tells them. It's really quite bizarre. So one of the things that we can do with this is there's a degree of motivational interviewing. And what I've actually found is that going through this, allowing him to set a quit date or a date at which he can reduce his use, is an incredibly powerful tool. But it's not just clear your vision. The Victorian Youth Drug and Alcohol Advice Service has actually gone virtual. This is just the most amazing web-based program and smartphone app designed to help young people like Toby reflect on the drug and alcohol-related needs. It really plays the role of a digital drug and alcohol counsellor, encouraging help seeking and offering next steps. This is really quite a brilliant construct, and I am sad that it currently only applies to Victorians, but if you do live in Victoria and you do have contact with young people who have substance abuse problems, this would be a fantastic first step. There are other just generic apps around alcohol. Ray's Night Out was developed at the Queensland University of Technology, and this is a really clever idea. The app can be downloaded for free, and users can take Ray the Panda out on a night, for a night out, basically. They can buy Ray drinks, and they can buy him food. They can even make him dance, and they can even make him flirt and play bar trivia. You can collect good vibe points to unlock rewards and essentially even take selfies. The idea behind this is to take good care of Ray. He is, in fact, a virtual friend. And it's all about not letting him cross his stupid line for drinking, where essentially a good night turns bad. I would encourage you to download this app, not because I'm suggesting for one moment that you have a substance abuse problem, but I just think this might be useful to some of your clients who might be able to make some use of this particular thing. And it just shows how you can gamify some of these apps and really make them quite interactive. I think this has huge utility from an educational point of view as well. So on to finally the issue of suicide and suicide prevention. Many of you would be aware of the fact that suicide is the 13th leading cause of death worldwide and is the leading cause of death amongst those aged between 15 and 39. One of the sad things is that Australia actually lacks an agreed upon national program of action on suicide. What we know is that the most effective way to combat this issue really involves a simultaneous system-based approach that includes medical health and community agencies within a region, all of whom who implement a specific set of evidence-based procedures. Now, many people have talked about the role of social media in suicide, and as Joe Robinson from Origin, the National Centre for Excellence in Young People's Mental Health, often says, social media often gets quite demonised when it comes to suicide. The reality is that we need to acknowledge the ubiquitousness of social media and ask whether or not it's possible to transform social media into a therapeutic tool to provide services and connect and empower young people who might be at risk. There's an excellent report on the Young and Well website written by Joe and her colleagues on suicide and social media. And I'd encourage you, if you don't download anything else, this is just a brilliant, brilliant publication. So why is social media demonized regarding suicide? Well, very often it is the case that in the wake of a suicide, particularly one that receives a lot of publicity in the media, online memorial pages, photos and comments often spring up and can normalize, sanitize and often glamorize the incident in a way that is thought to be really quite counterproductive and could in fact cause this contagious effect. There are any number of examples you can find on the internet, and I just put one example here. We also know, though, that social media isn't going anywhere. It has a role, and it's particularly interesting to look at cases like this one where a group of Melbourne young people were extremely disappointed in local professional responses to a particular suicide, and as a result created their own suicide prevention group on Facebook. Within a very short period of time, it had more than 20,000 members, and the group became so large so quickly that mental health professionals were enlisted to monitor the pages, with about 1,000 referrals to outside services made in just about 3 months. So this, I think, is a really stark example of how we can't ignore social media. We can sit around saying how dreadful it is, but we really need to use it. As I said, it's not going anywhere, and the truth is young people very often prefer using social media than seeing professionals. They're not particularly sophisticated consumers of healthcare, let alone mental health care, so that's very understandable. So the question is, how might we be able to engage in a positive and constructive way using social media to work with young people and provide a meaningful service to them? Well, internet-based treatment, as I've already said, through CBT, has become a very common way to treat adolescents with depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. And no one's suggesting this should replace face-to-face treatment, but there's a lot of evidence that it can be beneficial. One of the things that I don't think is clearly understood is that about 90% of the young people who take their own lives actually have a mental illness, and by far and away the most common mental illness is depression. Therefore, virtually any program, any web-based program, any app that addresses depression in terms of helping people understand it, get treatment, is in fact, and I believe, should be considered part of suicide prevention. We also know that text-only hotlines, which are very, very popular in the United States, play an important role in helping people in distress. There are any number of social media prevention and anti-stigma campaigns like Are You OK? That have been found to be very useful. And in fact, the United States is trialing, as we speak, a new feature on Facebook that allows users to report suicidal posts or content. And that is hopefully going to come to Australia quite soon. But are there specific apps that can help when it comes to suicide prevention? Well, there are currently quite a few suicide prevention apps, and many of them have been created for specific populations. My3, which I'll explain in a second, is a general app. There's Ask, another one. Guard Your Buddy, which is one of a number of military suicide prevention apps for people who are currently serving and people who have served. And iBobbly, which is one of the only apps which particularly target our Indigenous young people, and that was developed by the Black Dog Institute in Sydney. The problem with all of these apps is that there's a paucity of good evaluation. And this is something that the Young and Well CRC and, of course, organisations like the Australian Institute of Family Studies are very concerned about. Part of the problem, of course, with evaluating apps is that by the time you get an evaluation up, quite often the app has moved on. It is redundant and it's been replaced by another one. So trying to keep up to speed in this space is not always easy. So let me tell you about the app that I'm using in clinical practice as part of my work, particularly with suicidal and depressed young people. This particular app was developed in California. I do use it here in Australia only because there's nothing like it, but I really have to caution young people that the telephone numbers that it sometimes mentions are American helplines, not Australian. So this particular app is superb. I'm sitting with a client who I may believe to be somewhat suicidal, and I can simply ask him or her to bring out their mobile phone. I can get them to download this app in my office, and what we can do is together complete essentially a digital safety plan. They can actually send it to me, but they've always got it on their phone and they can send it to whoever else they like. It's basically divided up into six key areas. The first is we can sit together and record what might be the warning signs that they are perhaps going downhill. And we can customize these to the young person's particular situation, but there are also some generic warning signs that I would encourage the young person to consider putting in there. The second part is coping strategies. And again, I have my list, but what we can do is perhaps take a list of 10 and whittle it down to the top three that they really, really like. And that's what goes into the coping strategy plan. Distractions we know are a very, very effective way. And in fact, I will often recommend specific apps that will help them distract themselves. There's one particular one called Focus Up Pro, which I haven't mentioned in any of the slides, but it's a particularly good way of occupying the young person for quite a prolonged period of time. The other thing that I will encourage them to do is to establish a network. And the network really relates to the name of the app, My3. So I encourage them to download photographs of the three people who they would most want to talk to if they were beginning to feel down. And the way it works is as their photos are downloaded onto this app, so are the phone numbers. So in a moment of particular bleakness, they can just press on the photo of the person and their phone rings right the way through. There are also in section 5 a number of strategies around keeping themselves safe, and of course we also list My Reasons to Live. So this I think is a very clever app. I've just put some examples there of people one might put in, and I think you can see underneath there what I said about the American call 911. Someone told me recently in Australia that if you do dial 911, it does still go through to 000. I don't know. I've never tried it, but I'm being told that that is in fact the case. And of course, the problem is that the Get Help Now puts you through to the National Suicide Prevention Line in the United States. So you do have to warn people of that. Now, the good news is that there are, as we speak, several organisations actively building very similar apps here in Australia. And with a little bit of luck, they should be available. Some are being trialled as we speak. They should be available to workers with young people in health, education and welfare about halfway through next year. Certainly, if you log on to the Young and Well website, we would keep you up to date and informed as to what is going on. So what this particular website does, what this particular app does, is it allows you to help your clients create their own support system, literally build a safety plan. And there is a good deal of data to show that building safety plans work and is one of the most important components of helping young people who have suicidal ideation, or particularly those who you feel are tremendously at risk. And it enables them to access the important resources to get support at time of greatest risk. And we are very, very, I'm very impressed with the way in which this has been put together. So to end, I would just want to tell you a little bit more about the Young and Wells Certificate in Young People's Mental Health and Technology. Look, this is, as I said, a world first. It's in conjunction with Origin, the National Centre for Youth Mental Health at Melbourne University. And what we've done is we've put it online. There are four distinct modules: an introductory module, a module that looks at how one can integrate technology into clinical practice, one that looks specifically at suicide and self-harm prevention, and one that looks at the legal, ethical, and moral dilemmas working with this. Each module is just 7 hours. There are four of them, so all up it's 28 hours of online learning. And it contains readings, a whole vast amount of resources for you to use. One of the most exciting things about this is if you complete this, and it costs $250 per module, if you complete this, you'll then be eligible to do the graduate diploma, which we're writing at the moment, and then on to the diploma and the graduate diploma. As I said, this is a world first. We literally have first mover advantage. No one else has developed this particular type of course. And we have two streams, one for clinicians and one for people who are just interested in the general welfare of young people. So all you have to do is log on to the Young and Well website, click on the blue section there where it says Certificate in Young People's Mental Health and Technology. Make your expression of interest and we will be in touch with you. Well, I've gone to my allocated time. I'm now going to hand back to my friend and colleague, Ali Robinson.